The Dr. Taz Show.
The podcast.
Dr. Taz. Your good health journey starts now. Here's Dr. Taz.
Welcome back to the show. I am honored today to bring to you a topic and an expert that I think everyone should listen to. You know, the further I get along in my integrative practice, the more and more I understand how much of disease and illness is rooted in our minds and our emotions and in our energy. And while we all struggle to fix chemistry and to fix biology, if we don't really attack this other area, then we make very, very small shifts instead of making giant leaps. So I am thrilled today to bring you Miss Shira. Shira is a mindfulness-based psychotherapist, relationship expert, and meditation teacher who is deeply committed to helping people integrate painful experiences, adversity, and dysfunctional relationships into secure, resilient narratives. Shira specializes in rehabilitating relationships for both couples and individuals. She has a master's degree in clinical psychology from Pacifica Graduate Institute, and she is the founder of the Yale Street Therapy Group, an integrative mindfulness-based collective in Santa Monica, California. Welcome to the show, Shira.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Well, I am thrilled to have you, and you live in one of my favorite places in the world, in Santa Monica, so even more excited to have you on because of that. But all jokes aside, you know, this whole world of meditation and mindfulness is definitely a buzzword. It's definitely trendy. But as I mentioned in the intro, it is profoundly important to me because I've seen over and over again how impactful these changes are when it comes to even your physical health, and then that how in turn that all ripples and affects your life. I'm curious as to how you personally entered this world of mindfulness and meditation, and then how it has affected your practice and what's sort of evolved since then.
Oh, great question. I had always been interested in, mindfulness and meditation and yoga as a young person. And actually, when my husband and I met, that was something that really drew us together. And then I stopped meditating when I had children, which is probably when I needed it the most. Mm-hmm. And then we circled back around to it. And what I found in my clinical practice was that people who had a mindfulness and meditation practice, they seemed to do so much better. They seemed to be so much more responsive in being able to meet challenges where they weren't reacting emotionally as intensively. They were able to be more responsive in their choices. And the more I saw this, the more I realized, wow, meditation and mindfulness is such a powerful tool in the process, and got really excited about it, so much so that I really wanted to shift my practice to mindfulness-based work. And it's very profound how it helps, because it really gives you a way from the inside out. You realize you have choice in how you respond to difficult situations. And I think when you try to make changes, sometimes you have the insight, right? You have the cognitive awareness. Well, I'm really mm-hmm. struggling here. This is a really triggering issue. But you don't really have the ability to have a conversation with yourself in which you can make these incremental changes. And it's these sort of choice moments, these awareness moments that over time really move into big, big changes.
I couldn't agree more. And I often, you know, share so much of my own personal journey with all of this. And, you know, any of us that have grown up with maybe dysfunction that's inherited or dysfunction that we lived in or whatever the reason is, you know, we have deeply entrenched beliefs. You know, I feel like if I could open up the brain and remove them, it would be almost easier, but they're deeply entrenched within our psyche, so to speak. And so to shift that and change it, you know, it does take a mindfulness and meditation type commitment or practice. But I also know, both from personal experience and working with patients, that the minute those words come out of our mouths, you know, it's like a gray zone. It's like this big cloud, like that you can't cross over. It seems vague and unclear, you know? And so I would love for you to help us with, you know, dialing into these words, mindfulness and meditation. How do they become tangible to where you can really shift or change your mind? I mean, one quick personal story, you know, I, you know, run a pretty busy practices and I have a lot going on. And, you know, my stress response can average from being, you know, chill to extreme, depending on what's going on. And I made a commitment to myself to make my morning commute my mindfulness time or my meditation time, and would listen to just positive uplifting tapes or, you know, different types of things for, you know, for that 20, 30 minute drive. And I promise, you know, for everybody listening out there, by doing that for 30 days, there was a shift in me that I recognized pretty quickly. Instead of always resorting to the worst outcome or the worst scenario, you know, I myself became much more positive. So that's just one tangible way I try to explain to patients that this is how this shift happens. I would so love to hear what you have to say about it and how you can make this sort of vague term or terminology become a little bit more tangible.
Sure, of course. So, I mean, mindfulness is related to meditation. It's they're not exactly the same thing. Meditation has been around for centuries in the East, and was brought to the United States by Jon Kabat-Zinn in 1970, and he discovered in his work that meditation had a really powerful impact on pain. And so in its sort of secularized version, meditation practice is really sort of a simple practice of anchoring and connecting with the breath. It's one of the most simple practices you can do, and you can start just by 10 or 15 minutes a day anchoring into your breath and just noticing the thoughts, feelings, and sensations that arise in your body. And actually, I'm working with a meditation mindfulness app, Evenflow, that we're going to talk a little bit about later. Mm-hmm. There are all these wonderful apps now that make it very accessible and very easy for people to start a practice. But to circle back to mindfulness you can do anytime, anywhere. It is the practice of being in the present moment with your eyes open, let's say, on your morning commute, noticing your thoughts and feelings, but in a non-judgmental, compassionate way. So what both of these practices do is help you create almost an observer or a compassionate witness that's just noticing and not over-identifying with your thoughts, feelings, or sensations. And it's this ability that creates a little bit of space in whatever comes your way. So if you're really frustrated with something that happens, you don't immediately attach to that information. You mm-hmm. have a little bit of a that observer that lets you sit back and say, ah, I'm noticing that, you know, I'm getting tense, I'm getting frustrated, I'm getting angry, I'm getting anxious. And the more space you create, it becomes like a muscle, it becomes a muscle, mental muscle that you can use so that you're able to stay more anchored, more calm, less anxious, less depressed. I mean, they've done, I think, around 3,000 studies on meditation, how it changes the brain, and how it helps to emotionally regulate your system. So, and the research keeps going. I mean, it's really exciting what's happening in the field. And I would say, as a psychologist, we're very excited about the intersection between psychology and these contemplative practices that, right, they're easy to do, but they really create big change over time.
So it sounds like the key for everybody listening out there is learning to be an observer of your thought, learning to create a space between your thought and your emotion, and harboring and holding that space very delicately and almost treasuring it to a certain extent. Sherry, you talk about two aspects to our that merge between our thoughts and our emotions, that it's both our underlying beliefs, our narratives, and our value that mainly make our foundation of our sense of self and how we move in the world. And then there's an external layer of behavior and habits that reinforce them. And the underlying part is unconscious and not something we're immediately aware of, and that's where we get stuck. Again, is it holding the space is the best way to get unstuck? How do we emerge out of that? You know, how do we emerge out of those underlying beliefs and those narratives to shift on through and power forward?
Great question. You know, I think that's probably where the sort of the inner work, the therapy work, that's probably where that kind of conversation happens, right? How we define ourselves and all of these sort of pain points, right? I'm sure when patients come in and they're struggling mm-hmm. With symptoms, right? And the symptoms may be they're struggling with their weight, or they're struggling with their hormones, or they're struggling with fatigue. Sometimes we see similar things in therapy where we need to address the symptoms, but they're secondary, right? There might be an underlying belief or a system in place that we're not even aware of. Maybe you're in a marriage that's exhausting you, or you're having conflict with your children, or maybe you're in the wrong job, right? And the job is creating so much stress for you, and you're not realizing it immediately. You're more focused on the symptoms. So having a mindfulness and meditation practice can help you, as you said earlier, create some space and also some perspective, so you can start to notice things in a way that you're not so attached to. Sometimes we get very attached to the discomfort and the pain that we're feeling. Oh, I'm so tired. And then the tiredness turns into negativity, right?
Yes. Or
like an outlook on life that starts to be very enervating. It doesn't serve you. And strangely enough, right, if these pain points are actually doorways into a more interesting conversation about what's going on in your life, right? When you see some kind of an imbalance, deep imbalance happening, there's a moment, there's an opportunity to say, okay, what's not working? What's not serving me? So these practices are interrelated, but I'm sure you have these conversations with your patients too.
There may be
something else there that's not immediately on the surface, but comes into play. I think the deeper we're able to have and the more self-awareness we're able to sort of muster during the process to get past the pain or discomfort and into the bigger questions.
Okay, so for all my listeners out there who are trying to, again, harness this concept, so it's understanding that a lot of how we function in the world is based on underlying beliefs and values, and then our behaviors and our choices are reflective of that, and that space in between those two concepts is the space to change. And so doing things like monitoring your thoughts, being more mindful, having mindfulness practices can help navigate that change. I'm curious to see, and I want to jump into the app and just a minute, but I'm curious to help, you know, just to understand, because I know many women out there today and men are in relationships that may or may not be fulfilling. I'm curious to understand how this work impacts relationships and what somebody in a relationship or two people in a relationship can do to help each other move from those underlying beliefs into an actionable and shifting dynamic.
Great, fantastic question. So I do a lot of work with couples, and sometimes this is a perfect example. They might be having a fight that they haven't. I'm sure we all do this, right? There's a particular trigger, and we have the same fight over and over again about something, right? Taking the trash out or who knows what. And so what happens with couples is they get into a dance, a circle. They just keep going round and round and round. And oftentimes in relationships, the conflict is actually a bid, a solicitation for connection. But we never get to that connection point. We get cycled into a conflict that we're unable to step out of and see. So when you, even if it's just one partner, has some mindful awareness, and I wanted to also stress that a big part of this is having compassion for yourself when you're going through these difficult experiences or noticing difficult thoughts and feelings, that both of these practices advocate a compassionate stance, not a harsh, critical, negative one, but one that allows you to see, my goodness, we're suffering and this is hard. And that kind of softening is incredibly powerful. And that, let's say in the couple's example, if you can say, well, we're doing this again, we're getting through that fight, we're expending, there's a kind of energy that needs to be expended in that fight, but we're not actually connecting. If I can take a moment and say, wow, I see that we're starting again, I'm going to take 5 minutes and walk around the block, or even say to your partner, we're having this fight again, let's cool off, let's come back to it in a few minutes. Maybe the way that we're connecting is not, it's not useful, it's not productive, it only creates more, more negativity. Let's figure out if there's a way that we can come back to this later. And so back to the reactivity piece, right? If one person can say, I choose not to get into this reactive cycle with my partner, it creates space for another conversation. And maybe the conversation really is, wow, I'm stressed out. I had a long day. It would help me so much to take out the trash versus, why don't you ever take out the trash? You drive me crazy, you know?
Right.
And I think it helps foster also a different kind of language, which is really interesting. So much of our miscommunication and couples work has to do with unconscious language, where we solicit for whatever it is we think we want or we need in a way that actually pushes our partners away. And most of us are very unconscious of it. We don't realize, wow, what I'm doing isn't bringing me closer or isn't helping my partner understand what I'm going through or how I'm really feeling. And these types of practices really draw our awareness to, okay, what am I doing? What's my piece in this? Where's my work here?
I love it. And I see that with couples all the time, and then the shock, I guess, when someone checks out or someone strays or things like that. But it is a delicate dance, and it is important to stay connected, and you can't create adversarial roles and stay connected. I almost think too it's a challenge for women today, because we are in a different position. We're often in positions of power or in a different, you know, sort of dynamic than we were in maybe 15, 20 or even 50 years ago, that I've told so many friends and patients that what works in the boardroom is not going to work in the bedroom, you know, that there's a different connection to establish with your partner than there is when you're talking to a colleague or a coworker. And it's very important to be mindful of your tone and demeanor and all of that other stuff. And I think, you know, for many people, having that mindfulness practice so your brain is able to shift from situation to situation is critical as well. And I know has helped me just personally tremendously. You know, it's really helped me to understand where I am at any given moment instead of being on this train that just keeps barreling through everything I meet. But I want to talk about, so while we're trying to make this, you know, actionable, you know, you mentioned the app Evenflow, and you know, we already have Headspace, we have Calm, but as I was telling you, you know, before we jumped on, is that even in my own personal journey for some better tools, I found that there was not really a lot out there. You know, talk to us about the app and what it can provide given the context of what we've just talked about and how it might be different from what's already out there on the market.
Sure. So my husband and I did a lot of research. We had a particularly bumpy patch a couple of years ago, and we were curious about Headspace and all of those apps, and we found ourselves, they were wonderful, but wanting more, feeling like, hey, what, these are great. Beginner, I think, more of like get started, and if you don't have a practice or, you know, you're totally new to these ideas, but we were curious about the intersection between psychology and meditation, and what kind of meditation might help you get to the next place. And so we sort of arrived at Evenflow, which is very subject specific. We sort of set up the foundation, so if you're new to your practice, you can learn. It's very approachable and very easy to use. And then the next sort of way it's structured is that depending on relationships or health or career, we have a 911 section in case you're melting.
Oh, wow.
But the idea is to just take a little insight, a psychological insight, whatever it is, and build it into the meditation so that if you're struggling with something very specific, let's say if it's you're struggling with pain or you're struggling with your partner and you're having a conflict, or you're struggling with sleep and you need a little something extra to sort of almost, I think, integrate the practice into your life, then that's really the main point and the mission of the meditation, which is to make meditation really tangible to your experience. So as opposed to when we have meditations on gratitude and calm and all of those things, but let's say stress or anxiety, something that you're experiencing in your day-to-day walk that's really bothering you or really impacting you negatively, and as we all know, stress and anxiety can be not just emotionally and mentally debilitating, but can cause all kinds of physiological problems. So the intention was to say, okay, when you're down-regulated, when you're in a calm, receptive space, which meditation allows you to be, you're much more open to taking an insight in and sitting with it, right, and setting an intention, and then using that throughout your day when you encounter stress. Like, how many of us can escape to the Maldives for vacation?
Yes,
right?
Like, love it, but not realistic.
Not realistic. Or, you know, a meditation retreat if you're a busy working mom, that's not really available to you on a regular basis. So this idea of, wow, what tools can I take into my day and keep kind of cycling back to so that you're not in a perpetual stress out mood, or you're not perpetually anxious. You have, and this is not, so it's not therapy. It's not psychology in a sense, and in the formal sense, but it's definitely something that is like a next level approach to secular meditation, and we're really excited about it.
You should be excited about it, because I just downloaded it as you were talking, and I'm on here, and it tries to gauge the meditation according to your needs. And guys, this is my biggest pet peeve about mindfulness and meditation practices, is that I'm always limited for time, and I don't have time for a 40-minute or 1-hour session. These are amazing. They're all divided into like 9 or 10 minute little segments. Some are slightly shorter, some are slightly longer. But for example, I put in, you know, my big book launch is next week, so I put in anxiety and maybe a little bit of overwork and career transition, and it spit out some of the different meditations that I needed to do, which I'll probably do later today or tomorrow. But I think this is great, and I hope that more people get turned on to it and use it and really help them, you know, make these transitions in their life between, you know, kind of the way we grew up or what's embedded in us, and, you know, and maybe what's making us blocked or not allowing us to get to that next place or that next level. What is the best way for them to find out more information about you or about the app? Any of those things, maybe give us some pointers there.
Well, you can download the app on iTunes, the App Store. You can check out more information on evenflow.io, and you can find, I'm there. I'm one of the meditation teachers. The other piece I forgot to mention is that one of the big differences in the app is that they're all experts, either mindfulness-based psychotherapists or mindfulness-based meditation teachers. So You're getting it from people who are out in the field working with people with clinical issues every day, and so it's not somebody with just a lovely voice and good intentions. You're really dealing with experts, and let's say, for example, our sleep expert, Jennifer Wahlberger, she's been doing this for 25 years. So you're really getting information from people who are so deeply steeped in a strong knowledge base, that this is information you can trust. And we also felt like that was hugely important in creating an app that people could feel confident, right, that this information is coming from Critical. From an expert source. So
I love it. And then any recommendations too on where to put these mindfulness practices in your day and the structure of your day? I mean, for me, it's the morning. The morning is sacred. The morning is critical. It sets the tone for my entire day. Does it have to be the morning? Can it be at a different time? Any recommendations there?
No, morning is the easiest time. If you don't,
right?
If your children or your dogs aren't waking you up, just even setting aside 15 minutes a day in the morning or 10 minutes. But really, you can do meditation practice at lunch. You can do mindfulness practice with your eyes open on your commute. You can meditate in the evening, a little tougher if you're very tired, unless you're doing a sleep meditation. But there's no given sort of set time. You can really build it into your life in such an easy way. And you'll notice, like as you were saying, if you give it 20 to 30 days, you'll really feel it, not just in your head, but in your body. You'll feel that sense of calm, and there's nothing you have to ingest. It's not a diet regimen. I mean, it's really one of the easiest practices you can integrate into your life.
I would argue that it's not only one of the easiest, but perhaps one of the most critical, because, you know, as I dive into women's health issues, issues with our children, you know, issues with families and what makes a family fall apart or a family stay together, you understand more and more that it is our minds, it is the energy, it's the emotions, it's the intersection of all of that that then drives behavior. And yes. While you can, you know, I don't know how many patients have come into the room and said, well, I know how to eat right, I just don't know why I can't do it. Or I know I should be doing X, I just can't do it. And the I can't do it is typically being stuck in some sort of thought process and some sort of situation that doesn't allow you to move forward. So I would argue that it's one of the most important things you can make the time and space for in your life as women. And it's one of the most important things that you can hand over to your partners, your children, you know, the others in your life, to empower them and make them the amazing people that they all need to be. So Shira, thank you so much for joining us today. If my listeners want to learn more about your work and what you're doing, tell us where we should head. I know we have the app at evenflow.io. Where else can they learn more about your great work?
Oh, thank you. Thank you for having me on the show. ShiraMyrotherapy.com, also YaleStreetTherapy.com. I just did a TEDx talk in Culver City. That should be up shortly on the TEDx website, where we talk about redefining failures. But I really feel strongly, thank you so much for having me on the show, that there are so many ways to get into this work of self-awareness, and meditation and mindfulness are really some of the easiest, most approachable, but most profound ways to the path of wellness.
Thank you, Shira. Thank you so much for joining us. Everyone, get the app. I already downloaded it. It's awesome. And we look forward to having you on again in the future.
Thank you so much, Dr. Taz.
Take care.
Bye.